For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, we're blasting off out into space. Astronaut Tim Peake discusses his new sci-fi series for children and the risk that cosmic rays present to our eyes. Journalist Andrew Smith reveals what happened to the astronauts who walked on the moon after they touched back down on Earth in his fascinating book, Moondust. And Robert Kirkwood goes boldly into the archives to seek out the works of fact and fiction inspired by space exploration. That's all coming up on today's Read On.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Tim Peake is the British astronaut who inspired a generation. He's also a best-selling author with 4 books under his belt. And now he's joined forces with another star writer, Steve Cole, to create Swarm Rising, a novel for children in the middle grades, which explores themes close to Tim's heart in a page-turning adventure. Tim joined me from his home in Chichester. Tim Peake, welcome to Read On.
Hello, great to be here.
So, for anyone who hasn't yet picked up Swarm Rising, it's an alien invasion story with a difference. Could you just introduce us to it?
Yes, sure. So, Swarm Rising, it's essentially an action-adventure story. And as you said there, it's about aliens coming to Earth. But it's a lot more than that, because I was thinking, you know, when we travel outside the solar system, how are we really going to do it? You know, are we going to go as flesh and blood, organic form? Can we really travel for thousands of light years to get to other planetary systems? Unlikely. And I'd had inspiration from many other sources and thought, well, the future of humanity is probably that we get upload our brains into some future quantum supercomputer and travel through the solar system, through the universe at the speed of light as a digital intelligence. So what happened if alien civilizations did this millions of years ago and they are traveling currently through the universe? And that's how they arrive on planet Earth as a digital intelligence. And from there, the action adventure picks up. So it's been a huge amount of fun writing it with Steve Cole, who's a brilliant children's novelist. And we've had a lot of fun bouncing ideas off each other.
The swarm is the hive mind that has been uploaded and has come to Earth really to save us from ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of underlying themes there that hopefully, whilst, you know, young adults are reading it and enjoying the action and the adventure, also getting you thinking a bit about stuff like artificial intelligence, about how we need to be a little bit careful about that and think about what that might mean for humans, and to think about our planet, our environment. You know, why are the swarm here? Well, actually, because Earth is so precious as a cradle of life, one of the places in the universe that life can flourish, and that's what needs to be protected. And the swarm's less interested about humanity, but they are interested about planet Earth.
And you, as you say, you very much use it to explore your love of science, technology and ecology. And in Steve Cole, you seem to have found the ideal partner. He's written over 200 books for children already, including the book that I rather love, the Astrosaurs book about dinosaurs going into space. And he also worked on Doctor Who.
Yes, I know. I mean, it is so great speaking to him. And you can give an idea to Steve and say, listen, this is the concept I'm thinking about. And then he'll twist it and turn it and create a great narrative around. And we just bounce his ideas off. So it's wonderful to have that relationship and to be able to just explore these concepts with somebody who's got a brilliant mind for thinking outside the box.
I'm Danny Monday, but my story starts on a Tuesday. Hilarious, right? You can imagine the crummy jokes I've had to put up with at school my whole life, like, oh no, I thought it was Friday, but here's Monday. Or, who puts the week into weekday? Danny Monday. Or, you're going to marry Freya Knight, so you can call yourself Danny Monday Knight. Which doesn't even make sense, because A, I wouldn't have to take her surname if I didn't want to, and B, Freya Knight can break your bones just by looking at you, so I would not mess. Anyway, back to Monday on that Tuesday. It was just an ordinary night, you know. Mum out at work, homework half finished, Jamila round, being a pain. Nah, that's harsh. She's my best mate. I've known her all my life. We were in my room playing Breakout Saturn on PlayStation, stuffing Doritos and having a laugh. Or we were until Jamila totally got me killed by giant alien spiders.
Neka Okoye narrating Swarm Rising, written by my guest Tim Peake in collaboration with Steve Cole.
You're obviously very used to working in teams, and sometimes authors can be notorious for having egos. But I take it this really was a meeting of minds and just seeing what is possible.
Oh, yeah, definitely a meeting of minds. And that's what's great is that I've really been inspired by him. And at times, I think he's been really excited about some of the concepts that I've had and how space has changed my perspective of things about how we can travel outside the solar system and stuff. So we really have enjoyed working together.
I do remember from reading, I think it was Limitless, that you said that even though you were 400 miles above the Earth in the International Space Station, you never felt so close to Earth as when you were looking down on it. And that's when you really realized its fragility.
I think sometimes you have to take that step back in order to see the holistic viewpoint. And when you look at the whole planet from space, and bear in mind that it's not just the view, you've got this kind of serenity of floating in weightlessness, not feeling any forces on your body, no pressure points, just in this free fall around the planet in a perfectly silent, quiet environment, just gracefully gliding over at 25 times the speed of sound. And you kind of think, yeah, you know, I can put that into perspective. I can see now where we are, our position. And I think it just gives you that ability to really think carefully about what it is that Earth's doing for us, that tiny atmosphere protecting all life and the billions of years it's taken, not just to create life, but to create the planet itself.
You express it in, I think, one of those lines that somebody like Philip K. Dick or Asimov must have wished they'd come up with. I looked down between my feet and saw Australia flashing by. That's when the vertigo hit me. It's what they dreamed of, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you do have those moments in space where it just these things strike you and it takes you by surprise. But that's the great thing about having the privilege of traveling up there.
Your training was obviously very, very intensive, and they tested you mentally, psychologically, physically, in every way, shape or form. And yet you still admit that you were fearful at times up in the International Space Station, and that nothing can really prepare you for being that far from home and, well, in an alien environment.
Absolutely. And I think that's the part that you have to be really honest about yourself and honest with yourself about your fears. And what we try and do is we try and train it out of us. I've been doing that for years as a test pilot. We would look at, OK, something you need to go and do that's a high risk mission, a high risk sortie. How can we reduce the risk? How can we make it as low as reasonably practicable? And you do that by training and giving yourself options. So if something goes wrong, you feel empowered because you know what you can do about it. And for most of the occasions in space, you know, that training really pays off and it gives you the confidence you need. But there are always some times where you just think, you know, I am taking a big risk here and something really could go wrong that there's just no answer for. So that's always in the back of your mind.
Having read Limitless, I get the impression you were actually rather a shy and unassuming schoolboy growing up in Chichester. And when I read about the colleagues that you worked in the International Space Station with, I got the impression there's no real room for alpha male types there. It's not an environment where egos flourish.
I think you're right. I think it's something that the agencies spend a lot of time and effort on. You mentioned about the training, but also the psychological kind of selection process in terms of making sure we get the right personalities and characters who can live and work together, people who are great in teams, people who can communicate well. It doesn't really matter if you're the leader or the follower, because you're supposed to be able to do both of those roles simultaneously. And that's what we're looking for. We've changed a lot since the early days of the program, since the Apollo, since the Mercury 7. I think if you put the Mercury 7 into the space station for 6 months, it might be quite interesting, because they were a very different type of personality profile. And as we look to go further into space on longer duration missions, we need that diversity. We need that kind of personalities that people can just get on together in multicultural international environments.
And it's something that is a constant learning curve for everybody involved. Something I read recently was that the Apollo astronauts suffered from cataracts because of cosmic rays, which I assume you were probably aware of before you went up into the International Space Station. Were you worried, and what measures were taken to prevent you from losing your sight to cataracts?
Yes, we are obviously aware of the radiation exposure that we're going to get during a mission. And to put that into context, for 6 months in space, it's about the equivalent of 8 chest x-rays every day, somewhere on the region of 150 to 200 millisieverts over our 6 month stay. So it is an increased risk, but the agencies keep us below a 3% greater cancer risk than the average population. But you wouldn't want to be spending more than about 2.5-3 years in space under the current levels of radiation protection we have. The cosmic rays, you see them every time you close your eyes at night before you go to sleep, when you're just waiting to drop off. You see these flashes streak across your eyelids, and that is cosmic rays hitting the back of your retina. So we are aware every single day that we are in a radiation environment. We carry dosimeters with us. And when we came back from space, our eyes are tested before, after, and during. And there is evidence of radiation damage to the retina, small amounts of radiation spots. But again, it's very, very minor, and it's considered a very low risk. Something we've discovered recently, though, is that spaceflight can permanently change your eyesight in some astronauts, and some are more susceptible than others in terms of long-sightedness, so hyperopia. Now, in my case, I've come back from space and I have found myself to need reading glasses. But then again, I'm 49 years old, and most people over 40 probably are at that stage wearing reading glasses. So who knows? Maybe that's space. Maybe that's just old age. But we're more interested in the potential for long term damage through radiation exposure. And what we're doing about that, of course, is improving the radiation shielding on our spacecraft. When we go to Mars, we're going to have much better radiation protection. When we go outside the Earth's magnetosphere, where we get less natural protection from the magnetosphere, we need to strengthen the shielding again on our spacecraft. Currently, our crew habitation quarters, where we sleep, that's where we get the best protection. So if ever there was a solar storm or any increased risk of radiation, we would be instructed to go to our crew quarter.
And when people ask the question, well, is it worth spending all these billions of pounds on going into space? I take it your answer would be, we'll look at the amount of scientific research that we do in places like the International Space Station and that's currently going on the surface of Mars.
Often my first response is, well, let's look at what that financial figure is, because people say that sometimes, thinking back to the Apollo era and the kind of amounts of money that were spent back then, we're spending nothing like that these days. Our budgets are far, far smaller. In Europe, it costs the European taxpayer about the equivalent of a cinema ticket every year to do all of the research in space. That's not just the human spaceflight element. So in terms of our budgets, they're much more reduced. And what we get in return, of course, is all scientific evidence for the benefit of everybody on Earth. We're looking at sustainable techniques to improve solar efficiency, battery technology, water purification systems. We're looking at reducing the weight and increasing the strength of engine turbine blades and car vehicle engines so we can make them more efficient. We're looking at food production methods. So if we can grow food in space, we can grow food in the Sahara Desert. We're looking at protein crystal growth for drug development for Parkinson's, motor neurone disease, Huntington's disease. It's every day on board the space station. There's just a plethora of science going on that is all for the benefit of people back on Earth. It's not money being spent in space and being lost forever.
And that's something that your mission really brought home to all of us. I think you captured the hearts of an entire generation by your appearances and the hundreds of experiments that you were doing. And I think you interacted with over 2 million children in your 6 months in space.
That's right. I mean, it was quite interesting because when we started down this journey of having a mission, it was so valuable because I sat there with the UK Space Agency and we said, well, we haven't had this opportunity since Helen Sharman flew in 1991. And now it's a completely different era with communication, with social media, with video that we can transmit back down from the space station. We need to really embrace this. And we had this brilliant education program. And we thought if only half of these programs work, we'll call that success. And of course, we were blown away by how successful it was. And doing the cosmic classroom from space with Kevin Fong, for example, there were 500,000 school children tuned in just for that. And it's a lot of fun. But also, I think it showed how much excitement there is about science, space, technology. And I think that young people today really do embrace it, and they realize that technology is going to play such an important part in their future. And that's why they're interested in it.
And that's why it was a logical next step for you to write a book for children, I take it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a bit of a fun project that I wanted to do. It's been burning away, having two young boys of my own and loving reading stories to them and loving what stories that they enjoy. But also, I thought it's a great opportunity to write something that's fun, it's action-packed, it's adventure, but it has some really important underlying messages.
Well, those of us who have written books know that our children are our harshest critics. Have you been brave enough to give Swarm Rising to your two boys and accept the criticism?
Oh, not just to give it to them. They were instrumental in putting it together. I mean, we started talking about it when I was on a camping trip. I was living in Germany at the time when I was in Cologne, and we were driving to Slovenia to go camping. And that's a long journey. And we had plenty of time for me to bounce ideas off them, find out what they liked, what they didn't like, what they thought would work, coming up with the characters and the concepts. And since they've read every single chapter, so yes, I get the harshest criticism from them and feed that back to Steve and myself when we come up with different ways of doing things.
And I take it they're clamoring for the sequel already.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, they've really enjoyed it. And it's been wonderful having their input. It really has.
I know we've got Ask an Astronaut, the book that you wrote, to answer some of the enormous number of questions that you have received since getting back from space. And we've got that in the RNIB library, and it's read in a very entertaining way by Robin Ince. What is the question that you get asked most often, and what is the most left-field question you've ever had?
I think the question I get most often, certainly from the younger audience, is about going to the loo. It's about washing. It's about eating. It's about all those bodily functions that I think kids just love to think, well, actually, you know, what are the important things? How would I live in space? How would I do my day-to-day activities? And I always find it really interesting to talk to them about that. And that's where their fascination is. Lots of questions about aliens. Did you see UFOs? And I love that because often parents will be terrified to ask those sort of questions, but it's a very grown up question to ask. You know, we have some of the brightest minds on the planet currently looking for signs of intelligent life out in the universe, building rovers to go and explore planets for signs of life. So it's a really intelligent question to ask, and it's one that needs a proper answer. So that was always great. Some of the left field ones were things like, did you have a protocol for first contact? And I love the idea of sitting in a lesson from NASA about what to do if we had first contact, which of course there was no such lesson. Perhaps there needs to be one. And things like, you know, what was your favorite button to push on the space station, which was a button that opened the airlock out into space. That was by far the coolest button that you can possibly have on a space station.
And of course, anybody listening who wants to know whether they've got the stuff that astronauts are made of can read your book, The Astronauts Selection Test Book, to test their mettle.
Yes, I think what's really exciting at the moment is we've got a selection process running right now. So the European Space Agency have just closed the applications a couple of weeks ago, and now those successful candidates will be invited for the first round of testing. And we're looking to announce that probably late next year. And these are astronauts that will hopefully join the core in about 2023 to have missions potentially for the moon and maybe even to Mars. So it's really exciting. And that book just gives an indication of the kind of diverse number of skills that astronauts have to have and what those agencies are looking for when they select new candidates.
Do you ever still wake up thinking that you're still up in the ISS?
I don't, unfortunately. I wish I did. I've never been one who remembers their dreams that much. I did have a few dreams when I, you know, first landed where I felt I was still in weightlessness and still up in space, which is an incredible feeling. But no, unfortunately, I don't have those dreams anymore.
Well, hopefully reading Swarm Rising and the other four books that you have written will help a future generation achieve their dreams. But for the time being, Tim Peake, thank you so much for coming onto the show and discussing your life as an author and an astronaut with the Read On listeners.
Thanks very much, Red. Great talking to you.
Swarm Rising is out now in print, ebook and audio. And Tim Peake will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, our resident space cadet, Robert Kirkwood, probes the RNIB library for books inspired by space exploration. But first, not all astronauts have had such a smooth re-entry to life on Earth as Tim Peake did, as Robert Kirkwood found out when he interviewed author and journalist Andrew Smith.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm sorry, it's still not connecting.
Oh, is it? That's so weird.
Let's just do it via mobile, that's easier.
Sure.
This is author Andrew Smith, who joined me down the line via mobile after we couldn't get Skype to work. They can put a man in the moon, but we can't get two computers to talk to each other.
I know, yeah. The number of times I've heard that, it's true.
His book, Moondust, was first published in 2005 and has very recently been reissued with a new audio version for the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. Only 12 people in history have ever stood on the moon. They were treated like heroes upon departure, rock stars upon return. They've even been credited with helping end the Cold War. NASA spent billions to give them the biggest rush any explorer has ever felt, so you can begin to appreciate the cosmic dimensions of their eventual midlife crises. After you've been to the moon, whatever do you do with the rest of your life? The new audio version is read by Matt Jamie.
With hindsight, the astronauts' reactions should have been predictable. Suddenly, the 12 had to find answers to a question that had never been asked in quite the same way before. Namely, where do you go after you've been to the moon? In addition to their own hopes and expectations, they had the fantasies of faceless millions at their backs and millennia's worth of lore. The Nepalese, for instance, believe that their dead reside on the moon. When the Apollo 14 veteran Stu Rusa visited there, he grew increasingly flustered at being asked, "So, did you see my grandmother?" The walkers will forever be caught between the gravitational pull of the moon and Earth's collective dreaming. Charlie Duke grew angry as he admitted getting letters from conspiracy theorists who hold that the moon landings were staged and call him a liar. I liked Duke. At the age of 64, he was still tall and handsome, and spoke with a balmy drawl that seemed familiar, though it took a while for me to place it. I felt like a child lost in a favourite bedtime story as he described his flight, and the striking luminescence of our world as it moves through the lonely black void of space. From the moon, he said, the planet was like a jewel, so colourful and bright that you felt you could reach up and grab it, hold it in your hands and marvel at it like the precious thing it is.
That's a clip of Matt Jamie reading the recently reissued Moondust by Andrew Smith, And Andrew joins me down the line. Now, Andrew, this book started with an interview with Charlie Duke back in 1999.
Yeah, that's right. It was a fairly random thing, really. I was working at The Observer at the time, on the magazine there mostly, and there used to be a bit at the back of the magazine that was just sort of a straight one-page question and answer thing, and I used to avoid it because you couldn't do much with it. You couldn't be very creative with it or anything. But eventually, you know, the editor tapped me down and said, look, you haven't done one in a really long time. You've got to do one. And so I just sort of looked around about who I might talk to, and I found out that Charlie was in town with his wife, Dottie, who is quite a remarkable woman, I think. And in doing the research, I found out that he was one of the ones who'd come back from the moon landings and really struggled to fit back into everyday life. A number of them did. And things had sort of gone quite wrong for he and Dottie, but she really, very creatively, I think, put them back together through, you know, faith, religious faith. And so they were in London at the time talking about missionary work they were doing. And they were interesting and lovely people, actually. Charlie's very popular amongst all the other astronauts. But what I didn't know was that while we were talking, that the previous day, one of the other astronauts had had a motorbike accident, was expected to be fine. But as it turned out, he wasn't. And unexpectedly, word came through when I was with Charlie and Dottie that he died of his injury. And they were very upset. The man's name was Pete Conrad, and he commanded the second mission. He was very, very popular member of the astronaut corps. And so they were really upset. And then I stayed talking for longer. And as I was getting up to go, Charlie just said, now there's only 9 of us. And that really struck me, and it stuck in my head because it made me think, well, actually, one day there won't be anyone who's still on the moon, on Earth. And when I was still thinking about that a couple of years later, I decided that I really wanted to go and find out why it made me feel sad, that feeling, and also to answer the question, what you do after you've been to the moon. I mean, is the whole rest of your life going to be one big anticlimax? And that was sort of how it came about.
And of course, there were 9 alive at the time of writing, and now there's only just 4 remaining.
That's right, yeah, I know. I mean, I laugh at myself, my younger self, who thought, oh my God, they're in their late 60s, they're not going to be around for much longer. And I remember Alan Bean having a little chuckle about that. But they've, you know, NASA tested them thoroughly and chose them well, so they really have. But then they were all still here for a good long while, you know, happily. But in the last few years, yes, we have started to lose them at more of a rate. I'm really glad that I did it when I did.
And reading your website, it would appear that the death of Neil Armstrong hit you the hardest.
Well, he did hit me hard, yes. But I think that, you know, shared with many, many, many people, because he was obviously the most well-known of them all. And I always think he handled that bizarre position he was in very, very well. In personal terms, actually, I would say that there were 2 others that affected me more, which was Edgar Mitchell, who I really admired and liked very much, as I did Armstrong too. But I had more to do with Edgar, and I think he was a really unusual, unexpected person to find in that position, you know, having walked on the moon and been an astronaut. And also Alan Bean. He was the one I really stayed in touch with afterwards and had a lot to do with. And he's the one who came back and went on one of the most unexpected paths that he took after his moon landing, which is he stayed with NASA for a while, working on Skylab in the 70s, but then decided he wanted to become a painter. He'd always been creative and an artist. He was a gymnast at college and stuff like that. And so he did. He became a painter. He just painted scenes from the moon landing for the rest of his life and was one of the most contented people I ever met, I think. So he was a really fabulous character, him.
Yeah, they were kind of portrayed in the 50s and 60s and even 70s as kind of jocks, pilot jocks and fighter jets, but they're really quite complex men.
Yeah, they're not. It's funny that, because there are a number of things that, I mean, I was constantly surprised when I met them. The first one that I went to meet after Charlie Duke, obviously, was Edgar Mitchell. And you could not find, if you tried to design a human being who is not the image of the stereotypical image of the fighter jock, Man of Steel, he's pretty much what you'd come up with. He meditated every day. He was intensely open-minded. He thought that he'd detected a consciousness in the universe as he was coming back. And he was a scientist. He didn't believe it was a mystical thing, except that he ended up developing a kind of almost a mystical theory of the universe, although it's all science-based and based on atoms. And he spent the rest of his life trying to work out what that feeling was that he felt on the way back from the moon and what once he decided was consciousness, and then trying to work out, well, what do we mean by that? What is it? Which is obviously one of science's great mysteries. And, you know, was as open-minded as human beings as you're ever going to meet. So none of them were chosen with PR in mind, and none of them were chosen to be because they were steely astronauts either. They were chosen because they were really, really good at what they did and very clever. Most of them were pilots. Many of them were test pilots, majority of them were. So they were brilliant flyers. But most of them also had postgraduate degrees in engineering, science, things like that.
And as focused as they were up there, they did have those moments of reflection. I'm reminded of the story Neil Armstrong told about how he held his thumb up and blocked out the entire Earth.
Yeah, I know. It's the thing that I like about that story is that someone said to him, did that make you feel big? And he said, no, it made me feel really, really small. So you know, he had a sense. There's something very different about going to the moon. Everyone's surprised when you say this, including me, actually, and I know it. No one's left Earth orbit since 1972, since the last Apollo mission came back. And it's a really different thing. We've been up in space. Space is now part of the human environment, but it's only up to, say, 200 miles up. That's what we've done since. And it's a different experience because from up there, the Earth is huge and majestic, for sure. But it's only when you move away from it, it starts to get small. And I think that's when you see it in a cosmic perspective. And I think that's what the Apollo astronauts were really moved by.
The astronauts themselves, it didn't exactly set them up for life going to the moon because they weren't really paid very well.
No, well, most of them were paid according to their, the ones who were military were paid according to their rank. And, you know, the American military at that time was not particularly well paid. And they weren't all military, by the way. No, Armstrong wasn't. He was a civilian test pilot for NASA, but had come through the military. So, no, they didn't make a lot of money. And then, of course, at the end of 72, the whole thing stopped. So where they thought that they'd been pioneers on a new frontier and were going to carry on doing what they'd trained so hard, you know, for up to a decade to do, suddenly it stopped and they had to go and find other stuff. Most of them were around about the age of 40, which can be a tricky time anyway. So they had to go and find new jobs and careers. And it was odd because some of them, somebody like Buzz Aldrin was selling cars in a car dealership within a few years of coming back. One of them, Jim Lovell, who commanded Apollo 13, he went and he was piloting tugboats on the Houston Ship Canal and then running a company that ran tugboats. I found one of the command module pilots, the ones who didn't land, who stayed in the spaceship orbiting the moon while the others went. I found signing autographs at the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas, you know, with big queues at the tables of all the actors who were playing space people. And then, you know, a tiny little queue at the table of this man who actually did. So, yeah, they had a lot to deal with when they came back.
Who do you think was changed the most by the experience?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that was one of my questions when I set off to find them. How did it change? What were the changes? What were the things that caused the changes? Most of the astronauts that I've spoken to that had thought about that, I think Alan Bean was the first one who said it to me, I don't think anyone did change. I think everyone came back more like they already were, which I think is probably true. You know, those who had a religious bent came back with their religion affirmed and were more passionate about it. Those who came back, who went as scientists, essentially came back with more scientific questions and so on. And that does seem to be the case, that it galvanized them rather than changed them. It changed their perspective on the Earth. I think they would all agree with that.
Now, Moondust has been reissued with a brand new audio version read by Matt Jamie. What's new in the reissued version?
It's funny because I wanted to do a new edition because I never loved the previous one so much. I didn't like the cover. And so when I said to Bloomsbury, hey, look, why don't we do this? You'll do a new one. And normally what they like you to do is to do, you know, a new foreword or something like that. And I said, well, look, I don't want to do a foreword because I did that for the previous one. And it spoils the book for me because I think you spend a lot of time thinking about how to start a book and why put something new in between, in front of the start. And I always slightly regretted that. And so I said, I will write a new afterword. And they said, yeah, that's fine. And when I started to do the afterword, I started writing and I realized there was more I wanted to say than I'd realized when I'd first suggested it. And ended up writing basically a new chapter. So it's a 10th chapter to the book, which really updates it and talks about some of the interactions I have with the astronauts after finishing the book and about the direction that space has gone in because it's changed dramatically since I was doing Moondust when, you know, the thing that interested me about it was the extent to which it had been forgotten and the astronauts had been forgotten and no one was talking about going to space. it was really just something that we weren't going to do and weren't interested in anymore. And then look at it now. We're flying into space all over the place, and there are lots and lots of people pushing it. And I do think we have to credit Elon Musk, with who I've met and interviewed and write about in the afterwards. But I do think we have to credit him with quite a lot of that, actually. So that's new, and it's got a beautiful new cover, which we worked very hard at, and I really like that too. I have to say, I love Jamie's reading of the book too. I read the original audiobook, which gave me huge respect for actors, because I think it's the most tiring thing I've ever done in my life. When I finished it, I just went and collapsed in my hotel room bed. Did not get up for about 14 hours because it was so tiring. And I think he's done a wonderful job with it. I like his reading very much.
Yeah, people don't understand just how tiring reading a book is. Just that level of concentration is...
Keeping your energy up for those periods of time is sort of like 8-hour days. And I found it very difficult. I enjoyed it after the fact, but to say that I enjoyed it during the fact would be a gross exaggeration.
Now, you talked about Elon Musk and the future of space exploration. Do you think we will go back?
Yeah, it looks pretty inevitable now. I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago, but it does. It seems that pretty much everyone is talking about going. I mean, probes are being sent already. China has already sent them. And I do think now that that is likely to happen. My fear is that it's going to be viewed as just another source of natural resources that we can go and chomp up and destroy. So I'm hoping that that's not going to be what happens. But we'll see. And there's a lot of interest in the public now, which wasn't there to the same extent before. So it may well be that taxpayers, again, as in the 60s, are prepared to foot the bill. Mars is much further away because that's much more difficult. But going to the moon, we should be able to do relatively cheaply compared to the 60s, probably because our technology is so much better.
Now, given that you've talked to 9 out of the 12 people who've walked on the moon, what would you say to the new pioneers who hopefully will end up there?
Yeah, you have to imagine that the next phase will be a moon base at some point, which NASA is already talking about. I don't know. It's such a different thing because now they have so much more scrutiny and attention on them the whole time. I think the big difference between then and now is the 24-hour news cycle, which means that they're going to have scrutiny and attention focused on them the whole time, and people will all be looking for different angles because there's space to be filled online and on the airways and so on. And so they're going to need to be a lot tougher emotionally, probably, than they had to be first time around. They'll probably need to be less technically experienced than they would have been the first time. I mean, I think now they could probably send anyone for most of the roles that will go up, rather as on the space shuttle, which would be exciting because it means we could send scientists, we could send poets and writers, things like that. So that'll be good. But yeah, I mean, the advice would be suited to that and be ready for that, which was not any kind of a consideration first time around.
Now, we've talked about Matt's reading of your book. Is it important that it is available in alternative formats for everyone?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the audiobooks are one of the sort of growth areas of book publishing generally. So even sighted readers like them. So yeah, it's crucially important. And I'm as concerned with that as I am the print book. I chose Matt from a range of options, and it was very important to me. I made it a condition that I had to approve the reader.
Andrew Smith, thank you so much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Robert and to Andrew Smith. Moondust, In Search of the Men Who Fell to Earth, is available from the RNIB Library as TB14481.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Tim Peake to share the books of his life, mankind has long been fascinated by space travel, and it's led many authors to explore the universe through both fact and fiction, as Robert Kirkwood discovered when he touched down in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Some out-of-this-world books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And first up, possibly the first ever science fiction novel, Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon. It is the year 1865, and following the end of the American Civil War, the members of the Baltimore Gun Club are restless, and want to seek new ways of using their genius for invention and discovery. So their president, Impey Barbicane, sets his fellows a challenge to construct a rocket which can reach the moon.
The means of arriving thither are simple, easy, certain, infallible. And that is the purpose of my present proposal. A storm of acclamations greeted these words. There was not a single person in the whole audience who was not overcome, carried away, lifted out of himself by the speaker's words. "Hear, hear! Silence!" resounded from all sides. As soon as the excitement had partially subsided, Barbicane resumed his speech in a somewhat graver voice. "You know," said he, "what progress artillery science has made during the last few years, and what a degree of perfection firearms of every kind have reached. Moreover, you are well aware that in general terms the resisting power of cannon and the expansive force of gunpowder are practically unlimited. Well, starting from this principle, I ask myself whether, supposing sufficient apparatus could be obtained, constructed upon the conditions of ascertained resistance, it might not be possible to project a shot up to the moon."
The wonderful voice of Garrick Hagen, reading From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne. And from early science fiction to early science fact, Rocket Men, the epic story of the first men on the moon by Craig Nelson. This text follows the story of the Lunar Project, beginning at its inception at the start of the Cold War and tracing it through to its finest hour with the first moon landing and the astronauts' safe return. Through extensive interviews with astronauts, NASA staff and their families, and never-before-published documents, Craig Nelson presents an awe-inspiring human account of the voyage that changed the course of history.
Before getting to ride their rocket, Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins each spent 2.5 years amassing over 2,000 hours of formal training. Dave Scott, who served with Neil Armstrong on Gemini 8, kept a detailed journal of his own Apollo regimen for the year 1966. 270 hours on operations, 300 hours on systems, 350 on equipment design, 370 on spacecraft tests, and 680 in module simulations. Besides working in NASA's own trainers in Houston, Kennedy, and Edwards, Apollo crews tested the command module at North American's Downey, California plant, and the lunar module at Grumman in Bethpage, Long Island. Armstrong's direct training for Apollo 11 totaled 959 hours, with 285, 30%, spent in LM simulators. Aldrin logged 1,017 hours of training, with 332 hours, 33%, in the LM. But these numbers did not include the time spent in camera lessons, astronomy class, the gym, giving press interviews, or the hundreds of hours of travel time in T-38s between Downey and Grumman and Kennedy and Houston, or to Panama for survival training, or to the Gulf of Mexico for water landings, or to the Texas Big Bend, the Grand Canyon, Arizona's meteor and sunset craters, and an Oregon lava field for geology field trips, or to the dozens of other locations housing specialized machinery for education that only NASA could conceive. Even so, training was only about one-third of our time and effort, Neil Armstrong added. A third had to do with planning, figuring out techniques and methods that would allow us to achieve the trajectories and the sequence of events and the ways of picking from the available strategies the one that might work the best.
Rocket Men by Craig Nelson is read for you by Peter Brook. We've already heard from Jules Verne, but that voyage to the moon was already imagined by another classic science fiction master, H.G. Wells, in this dramatisation of The First Men in the Moon.
50 feet, Professor, and drop in.
We'll be landing soon.
20 feet, 10 feet.
We're going to open!
Welcome to the moon, everyone!
Professor! Is that you? I looked out, but now I can't see!
The light has burnt out his eyes.
Something touched me! Wet, slimy! Can you see it?
Something's in here, Gibbs.
You mad, Professor! I think I love you!
Good, run!
I don't want to run! I want to die!
We present James Bolam as Bedford and Donald Sinden as Professor Cavour in First Men in the Moon by H.G. Wells.
The voices of Donald Sinden, James Boland and others as they journey through space to man's first incredible voyage to the moon. And also available, and once again moving from science fiction to science fact, an incredible dual biography called Two Sides of the Moon, Our Story of the Cold War Space Race, by David Scott and Alexei Leonov, with a foreword by Neil Armstrong and an introduction by Tom Hanks. The two authors grew up on either side of the Iron Curtain, but shared the same dream, to fly. They became elite fighter pilots and were chosen by their country's space programs to take part in the space race to land a man on the moon. In this dual autobiography, they recount their exceptional lives and careers. They tell of missions fraught with perilous risks, adventure, heroism, and tragedy.
United States President John F. Kennedy asked the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to report on our ability to successfully compete with the Soviets. The NASA officials told the president that the United States could not provide the first space laboratory and only had a slim chance of flying around the moon first, but would have a chance, with a concerted national effort, to land a man on the moon first. Although this was an arena in which he knew little, Kennedy concluded that the United States must be in the race and must perform well. He received the support of the Congress and of the American people. The race was underway. This book is the story of that race as told by two of the principal competing participants. Each side respected the other. They were, in fact, able to understand, perhaps better than anyone, the problems, challenges, and risks before them. On rare occasions, the competitors met at international events and technical conferences for short periods and found that they liked one another, although, coming from opposing sides, they did not know whether they could trust one another. Two Sides of the Moon interweaves the tactics of the Soviet program with those of the American effort. The reader will see the plans being developed in the training and operation centers in Moscow and Houston, and will live with the cosmonauts and astronauts inside their spacecraft as they learn to exist and survive in dangerous and inhospitable space. Dave Scott and Alexei Leonov have each borne the enormous responsibility of commanding spacecraft and of representing their respective countries in the most fascinating and most expensive race in human history. This is their transcendent recounting of that competition. Neil Armstrong, 2004.
Two Sides of the Moon, Our Story of the Cold War Space Race, by David Scott and Alexei Leonov, is read by Cameron Rhodes. And finally, a blend of science fiction and science fact, as we set our sights further afield and have a listen to Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration, by Buzz Aldrin. Legendary space statesman Buzz Aldrin speaks out as a vital advocate for the continuing quest to push the boundaries of the universe as we know it. As a pioneering astronaut who set foot on the moon during mankind's first landing with Apollo 11, and an aerospace engineer who designed an orbital rendezvous technique critical to future planetary landings, Aldrin has a vision. And in Mission to Mars, he plots the path he proposes, one that will take humans to Mars by 2035.
It was April 15th, 2010, when I stepped off Air Force One, one of several guests invited to travel with U.S. President Barack Obama to the John F. Kennedy Space Center at Merritt Island, Florida. I had some inkling that he was going to push the reset button on the U.S. space program. As he began a formal address, President Obama was kind enough to recognize me among those gathered. It was certainly ego-lifting to hear him say, "Four decades ago, Buzz became a legend. But in the four decades since, he's also been one of America's leading visionaries and authorities on human spaceflight." Welcomed words, but I patiently waited the punchlines of his speech. Now, I understand that some believe that we should attempt a return to the surface of the moon first, as previously planned, the president said. But I have to say, pretty bluntly here, we've been there before. Buzz has been there. There's a lot more of space to explore, and a lot more to learn when we do. Obama then called for a series of increasingly demanding targets, made feasible by advancing our technological capacity with each progressive step forward. Early in the next decade, a set of crewed flights will test and prove the systems required for exploration beyond low Earth orbit. And by 2025, we expect new spacecraft designed for long journeys to allow us to begin the first-ever crewed missions beyond the moon into deep space. So we'll start by sending astronauts to an asteroid for the first time in history. By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it, the president explained, greeted by bursts of applause throughout the rollout of his prospective missions.
Buzz Aldrin's Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration, is read for you by John Pruden. For more information on any of these books, or indeed any books in the RNIB library, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now it's back to Tim Peake for the books of his life.
Tim, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, there are many books. I mean, when I was younger, I used to love reading. From a very early age, one of my favourite books was The Flying Hockey Stick by Roger Bradfield. And this was about a young lad who took off on a hockey stick powered by an electric fan and visited all these places until the cable ran out. And it was wonderful. It opened up my imagination to these kind of possibilities. But as I got older into my teenage years, I loved reading Hammond Innes books, action, adventure, thrillers, and some of the places that he would take you to. I remember one of his books, I think it was The Land God Gave to Cain, which was set in Labrador, and just, you know, transporting myself to this landscape, this desolate, remote, cold landscape. And it really grabbed my attention and just thought, wow, what it would be like to go and explore those kind of areas.
Unfortunately, The Flying Hockey Stick by Jolly Roger Bradfield isn't available in audio. But here's a clip we found on YouTube, narrated by Will Saris.
Barnaby Jones was a boy who had wanted something for years and years. He wanted more than anything to be able to fly like a bird. Ever since he could remember, he had been trying to make some sort of machine that would get him off the ground, if only for a few feet. He made a glider, but it wouldn't glide. He made a helicopter, but it wouldn't go up, only down. Barnaby had tried various combinations of orange crates, balloons, old boards, washing machine parts, and a lot of other things, but he could not seem to come up with exactly the right combination. But, as usually happens when one keeps trying and doesn't give up, he finally found a way.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
My guilty secret are Bernard Cornwell novels. I love them. I just think it's pure escapism. It's fun storytelling, but it's also a little bit of history in there as well. I think it's faction, isn't it? They call those kind of novels. So yes, I would curl up with the Bernard Cornwell and probably the Warlord Chronicles.
Once upon a time, in a land that was called Britain, these things happened. Bishop Sansom, whom God must bless above all the saints living and dead, says these memories should be cast into the bottomless pit with all the other filth of fallen mankind. For these are the tales of the last days before the great darkness descended on the light of our Lord Jesus Christ. These are the tales of the land we call Hrogir, which means the Lost Lands, the country that was once ours, but which our enemies now call England. These are the tales of Arthur, the warlord, the king that never was, the enemy of God, and, may the living Christ and Bishop Sansom forgive me, the best man I ever knew.
Jonathan Keeble narrating The Winter King, the first in the Warlord series by Bernard Cornwell, which, along with the rest of the series, is available from the R&IB Talking Books Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, the one I read recently, which I loved, was Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir, his new novel. And that's just brilliant. I love Andy's humour and the fact that he takes these scientific concepts and he makes his books as accurate as possible. And this book is all about travelling beyond our solar system to try and save the planet from an alien invasion that's attacking our sun. It sounds very far-fetched, but it's a brilliant novel and I really enjoyed it.
What's 2 plus 2? Something about the question irritates me. I'm tired. I drift back to sleep. A few minutes pass, then I hear it again. What's 2 plus 2? The soft, feminine voice lacks emotion and the pronunciation is identical to the previous time she said it. It's a computer. A computer is hassling me. I'm even more irritated now. I say. I'm surprised. I meant to say, leave me alone. A completely reasonable response, in my opinion, but I failed to speak. Incorrect, says the computer. What's 2 plus 2? Time for an experiment. I'll try to say hello. I say. Incorrect. What's 2 plus 2?
Ray Porter narrating Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir, which is available commercially.
Tim Peake, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.